Welcome to True Crime 101 with Murder Friends, the podcast where three friends from three different countries talk murder. My name's Alana and I'm Canadian.
I'm Anna and I'm American.
My name's Hannah and I'm British.
In addition to our longer episodes, True Crime 101 talks you through key true crime cases and theories. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I have my Murder Friends mug of mulled wine.
Yes.
Get comfortable. We are finally going to talk about the Highway of Tears.
Wow. Oh.
For those of you who don't recognize it, if you're into true crime, Highway of Tears does sort of crop up every now and again. It's not necessarily one case, but it's like a region of cases, which makes it quite unique, I think. So I figure I would give you guys like a brief overview, and I know some people message me after the episodes air and they're like, oh, I really enjoyed Blood. And I ended up doing a deep dive on it. It was really interesting. Highway of Tears is a deep dive kind of thing. So if you are into that sort of thing, this is the one that can give you hours of research. So we're going to do like an overview to get it going. So the Highway of Tears is a stretch of road in Canada, which is home to the disappearance and or murder of, at this point, an unknown number of people. It's about 725 kilometers or 450 miles. It's a corridor of Highway 16 between Prince George and Prince Rupert in British Columbia, Canada. So this one sort of stretch of highway has been the location of murders and disappearances beginning as early as 1970, but could be earlier. And at the end of this, we'll talk about some of the cases. I sort of picked a few over the years. They believe the earliest is 1970. We also have one from 2020. So this is an ongoing thing. It's not a, you know, like 1970s thing that we hear about. No, it started then and it is still going.
It's terrifying.
So the phrase Highway of Tears was coined during a vigil held in British Columbia in 1998 by Florence Nazile. Now, there's a lot of names in here, which I am not good at pronouncing. I'm so sorry. She was actually one of the family members of a victim. And she says she was thinking of all of the families crying over their loved ones in this one particular area. And she says, you know, Highway of Tears. And that name has sort of stuck, rather. I probably shouldn't have started the mulled wine this early.
It sticked.
I mean, realistically, this whole thing is so heartbreaking when you just think of the absolute scope of it all. And I mean, I'm sure there are ones that we don't know about or that we will ever know about. But ever since then, 1998, cases of disappearances or murders in this area are referred to as the Highway of Tears, although technically they may not be related. And we will get to more on that. In this area, there is a disproportionately high number of Indigenous women on the list of victims. So there's a lot of debate on explanations for this and why so many of these crimes occur. There are lots of factors, including poverty, drug abuse, widespread domestic violence, disconnection with their traditional culture, and the disruption of the family unit through the foster care system and the Canadian Indian residential school system. I know we talked about residential schools briefly on various episodes. But in short, there's a lot of trauma in that and generational trauma. So even though it may not have happened to you personally, it could have happened to your parent or your grandparent, and that is really passed down. So unfortunately, there are a lot of factors fighting against Indigenous people and women, especially. And one of the interesting things when we talk about poverty in this area, it can lead to low rates of car ownership, obviously. You know, if you're living in poverty, the chances that you own a car could be quite low. So unfortunately, hitchhiking is often the only way for many people in this area to travel, whether they need to see family, whether they need to go to work or to school, or even to get medical treatment, you know, the only way might be hitchhiking. And unfortunately, we've all read stories or watched documentaries about hitchhiking being involved in crime. Another factor leading to the abductions and the murders in this area is that it's largely isolated and remote. If you have ever seen pictures of like rural British Columbia, you've got these huge just forested areas. There's a lot of wildlife in these areas that would be happily scatter remains, you know, if you were to leave a body somewhere. And they talk a lot in the research that I did that perpetrators can really feel a sense of privacy in these types of areas because it is so easy to carry out a crime and have no one see you. And it is so easy to hide evidence and it just be whether scattered by wildlife or so remote that there's no chance that people would find it. Another important thing to remember is there are 23 First Nations that border this highway. So like we said before, the region is characterized by poverty. And until 2017, this blew my mind. Until 2017, it did not have adequate public transportation. So, I mean, we're talking 2017. So all in all, it's a perfect storm. There's poverty rates, there's remote areas, there's hitchhiking. And we also have to talk about Indigenous women who, unfortunately, the police worry about far less. So a higher proportion of them can go missing before anybody raises the alarm, which is fucking disgusting. And unfortunately, a large part in why this area has become so infamous. Now, accounts vary to the exact number of victims, which is confusing, but we can understand why. I mean, there's going to be loads of people that have gone missing that we won't even know about. But the RCMP launched Project E-PANA, specifically for the Highway of Tears area, and they list the number of victims is fewer than 18. But Aboriginal organizations estimate the number of missing and murdered women ranges above 40. So we have quite a large discrepancy.
And even then, like, 18 is enough.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? 40 is 18. Ridiculous. Is a ridiculous amount. But 18 is enough for you to be very concerned.
Yeah. There's something going on
there. Two is enough for you to be very concerned.
Yeah.
One dead woman is enough for you to be concerned.
The Wikipedia page actually has a really great list on Highway of Tears. So it includes all women within the Highway 16 corridor between Prince Rupert and Prince George who went missing, who were murdered, or who had an unknown cause of death. There are almost 80 names on that list, which, if you ever want to go down that route, go ahead on a deep dive because, oh my God. To date, there's been a number of people actually convicted in cases relating to the Highway of Tears. There's actually 3 separate serial killers who are among those charged in this area. RCMP Sergeant Wayne Clary said they may never solve all the cases, and it will be the people in the communities that are going to solve these cases. So they do have persons of interest in several open investigations, but as you can imagine, very little evidence in this area. So like I mentioned before, in 2005, the RCMP launched a provincially funded project, E-PANA, which started with a focus on some of the unsolved murders and disappearances of young women along Highway 16. So E-PANA was trying to figure out if there was a single serial killer at work or a multitude of killers operating along this stretch of highway. So when it started in 2005, they had 3 cases. Then the unit investigated 9 cases by the following year. By 2007, its caseload had doubled to 18, and the geographical scope began spanning larger areas of the province and not just this one highway. So the victims involved in E-PANA had to follow a very specific criteria. They had to be female, participating in a high-risk lifestyle, known to hitchhike, and were last seen or their bodies were discovered within a mile from Highway 16, Highway 97, and Highway 5. So in the 2009-2010 year, E-PANA received over $5 million in annual funding But as you can imagine, that has just been cut back. In 2014, a Freedom of Information request stated that the task force had dropped from 70 officers to 12, and their budget is around 800,000 versus the 5 million they had to start with. Now, there are some successes, like I was saying. EPANA is responsible for linking the homicide of a 16-year-old Colleen McMillan, who was killed in 1974, so an older case. They were able to link her with the now-deceased American serial killer Bobby Jack Fowler. They also consider him a suspect in murders of two other highway victims, Gail Ways, and Pamela Darlington, both of whom were killed in 1970s. Of course, he is now deceased, so I don't think they're moving forward with that, but they do suspect him as being the culprit for these two other women. More recently, in 2014, investigations by EPANA and the Provincial Unsolved Homicide Unit brought murder charges against Gary Taylor Handlin. God, the mulled wine, I swear to God. For the death of a 12-year-old Monica Jack in 1978. So he was found guilty by jury and sentenced to life in prison in early 2019. So this is a crime. I mean, she died in 78. He was finally sentenced in 2019. And his conviction is like the first file in EPANA to be officially solved with full court proceedings and sentencing. So, I mean, we've got one win, I guess, and one kind of win, but there's a whole lot else that is just kind of sitting there. Now, one of the big things, unfortunately, racism. Surprise. Some critics argue that the lack of results arising from these investigations is a result of systematic racism. There is also reported to be an issue in the case of like Robert Picton's murders, which we cover in its own 101 episode. Unfortunately, things are often overlooked because half of the missing women are First Nations. That's a reality. Activists argue that the media coverage of these cases have been limited, saying, you know, we assign a lesser value to Aboriginal women. It's also interesting, even just to consider, that despite the fact that these disappearances date back as far as like 1969, 1970, it was not until 2005 that Project EPANA was launched. I mean, they just kind of sat on their hands for that one.
Wow.
There was a Caucasian woman who disappeared in 2002, Nicole Hoar. That's unfortunate. H-O-A-R. I'm so sorry. Nicole received a disproportionate amount of media attention at the time of her disappearance. And hers was the was the first Highway of Tears case to be covered in the Globe and Mail, Victoria Sun, and the Edmonton Journal, which are three very large newspapers. So hers was the first one to be covered. A Native activist and the aunt of one of the victims basically says, you know, if it wasn't for Nicole, the police would have been invested way less in investigating these cases, and the media probably wouldn't have necessarily heard about it until hers came forward. And then I think people started realizing, like, holy shit, there's a lot of people that actually have gone missing that we maybe never have even heard about. So I thought we would go through some of the missing and or murdered women from this highway. And I've kind of picked out some women over the years. And you can kind of see what type of cases have happened here. These are all from the Wikipedia page that has about 80 names. So these are not necessarily EPANA victims, because they think there are only 18 that fit their criteria. But of course, there's way more women who have gone missing or who have been murdered. And maybe they don't fit that particular criteria, but they are obviously still important. So if we start with Tracy Clifton, she at this point is missing. The exact date that Tracy went missing is not public knowledge. It was reported at an inquiry for murdering and missing Indigenous women as being sometime in the 1970s. That's kind of all we know. She had an argument with her mother and left home and started walking Highway 16 and was never seen again. No current suspect reported. just disappears. And that, unfortunately, is a really, it's a reoccurring trend, which is just terrifying. We also have Monica Ignace. She was only 14. This is 1974. It was believed that she was going home from school when she was last seen at around 11 p.m. In December 1974. She was walking home alone. Her body was found that following April. Two witnesses reported seeing a car pull over to the side of the road the night that she vanished. The pair saw a man and a passenger who looked like a girl inside the vehicle. Monica had been strangled, and there is no current suspect reported.
Jesus.
I mean, it goes on and on. Fast forward to 1989. We have Cecile Nicole. She was last seen that October. This broke my heart. So she's last seen in October, a year before her cousin, Delphine Nicole, went missing. Reports of her last known location vary. Cecilia also had a cousin, Roberta, who was murdered a few years after the other cousin disappeared.
Oh, my God.
And Cecilia, I mean, she's 15, and she has two cousins who have also either been murdered or missing. We have Ramona Wilson from 1994. So Ramona was hitchhiking, which, I mean, as you do, unfortunately. She was going to attend a dance and stay with friends in a like neighboring town. She was 16, and her remains were found about a year later. What's really creepy about hers is there was several items in a small organized pile a few feet away from her remains, but there was also other objects nearby, like a half-buried small section of rope and interlocking nylon ties. No suspect from 1994. There are other ones, unfortunately, that mimic that sort of idea. Aliyah Katrina Sarik Uger, quite a long name, 14. This was 2006. She was found, her remains were found shortly after she went missing in February. She was going to the mall, you know, she's 14. Going to the mall with her brother and her sister, and then she went to a friend's house for a sleepover. Afterwards, she was spotted walking north, and there's video surveillance of her walking, like, back to her home. But then it was reported she was seen getting into a black van, and then, you know, her body was found shortly after that. It's not just younger women hitchhiking. Like I mentioned, there are three separate serial killers that have come to this particular area. One of them was Cody Legbokov. What a name, that was not pronounced properly. But he had multiple victims. And this is from like 2009. So it, I mean, it's recent. We have Jill Stachenko. She was 35. Her body was found in October 2009 in a gravel pit on the outskirts of Prince George. She was known to have engaged in sex work. Cody went after women who were sex workers and unfortunately maybe didn't get that much media attention. But he was arrested and he was actually convicted. So, there, I mean, there is a positive. He was found, but this was 2014 when he was finally convicted of first-degree murder. He was also convicted of first-degree murder in the deaths of Lorraine Lensley, Jill, like we spoke about, Cynthia Frances Moss, and Natasha Montgomery. Cody, if you can picture a Cody, he's probably exactly as you picture. He was just 20 years old when he was arrested.
Oh, my God. 20 years old?
Yeah. Shocking, right?
Yeah.
Well, he was convicted in 2014. He was arrested in 2010, and he had killed these women. He was just 20.
Gosh.
I mean, we could go on and on. They're all pretty heavy. Unfortunately, there is a lot of hitchhiking involved, but there is no adequate public transportation. So if you don't have a car and you don't have someone to drive you around, like, that's your next go-to. We do have the most recent one, however. This is from August of 2020. Crystal Chambers. Her remains were found on August 1st, 40 kilometers east of Prince George by Highway 16. The remains were retrieved with the assistance of the search and rescue. And they're investigating, and they sort of talk about she had a relationship with this one man, Ray Lorraine, who is obviously a suspect, but nothing formal has been reported. But that is literally August 2020. So I think that's what's so eerie about Highway of Tears, is that it is such a long-spanning, crime-ridden location, if you can say that.
Yeah.
It's not just, you know, Cody's story alone is absolutely frightening, that such a young man killed so many women. But it's like, it's that on top of everything else, on top of all these other women and realistically children. I mean, we got 14-year-olds who have gone missing or who have died in this particular area. And there's so many components that go towards it, you know, like hitchhiking, like we talked about. And it's just, one of those things that if you need to do a deep dive, there is a lot here. And the Wikipedia page itself has 80 different victims. Of course, some of them are not the same MO as the EPANA is looking at, but they're still victims in this one particular area, which I find just so, it's so eerie.
Do you think that the EPANA specifications is too narrow? In that, I think the thing that stuck with me when you were explaining it was that they were only looking for, you know, remains found within 1 mile. That's nothing compared to the size of the area surrounding that road, surely.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of outcry, especially with the native community, that you can't be so narrow in the geographical scope, because they're saying like within a mile of certain parts of the highway. And they're like, no, that's not fair.
Any able-bodied person would be able to drag a body for a mile if they wanted to hide it.
Yeah, or you drive into the forest.
Exactly.
Yeah. It seems like, I know it's probably funding issues or whatever, but like, you wonder if they're doing any preventative things? Like, are they trying to put up more CCTV along the roads? Can they, like, why aren't they funding public transportation? Well, they are now, right? So there is more now, but like, I don't know. You think, okay, obviously this is like a particular place where I say this very like where people dump bodies because it's so remote and things like that. Like, I know that in California and stuff like that, there's a park that's quite famous, can't think what it is, that a lot of bodies have been found in. And it's not all the same person, but it's because obviously if it fits the whole criteria of, oh, it's remote, nobody will see me, I can just come off and go off into the woods, you know, all those things. And then you can easily find victims, unfortunately, walking along the road. So yeah, you just wonder what, if they do have it, if they're doing things that can help prevent this, maybe? I mean,
yeah, it's tricky because we're talking about, like, I think it was 450 miles. Mm. And that's only that very specific area that the RCMP are focusing on, is 450 miles. So even if you had like CCTV stationed every once in a while, it's so big that it's a struggle. And they also talk about, there's a whole bunch of documentaries. That's what I meant to talk about. Sorry. If you want to learn more, the Highway of Tears on Wikipedia is actually really fabulous, and I would give that a look, especially if you want to deep dive into the specific cases, because they have all 80 women and the details. There's also a really good documentary just called Highway of Tears from 2015. It's a Canadian documentary directed by Matthew Smiley, unrelated, and narrated by Nathan Fillon. There's also a website called highwayoftears.org that has more details. Crime Junkie has a podcast specifically on serial killers and Highway of Tears. There's also a really cool podcast by the CBC News called Who Killed Alberta Williams? So this focuses on one specific highway victim, Alberta Williams, and the response to her murder and a lot of things we talked about, you know, the native implications and that kind of stuff. So there are definitely loads of things online if you wanted to do deep dives. It's just a lot. And that's why I kind of put this one off, because there's so many people involved and there's so many cases and so many different impacts, you know, like we said, poverty and the fact that the police don't really look at Indigenous women the same way, and funding, like you said, Anna, this,
yeah,
everything is sort of cut down. I did read on one of them that they did wonder whether truckers had some involvement, because it's such a popular, like, trucking area, whether it's coming up from the U.S. or throughout Canada. And so you have people who are not from the area just sort of passing through at such a high volume that it would be really difficult to catch anyone if they were to commit a crime, you know, along this route. So, yeah, there's so many different options and stories and all that stuff. It's pretty heavy.
Yeah, well done for diving in, really, because I know it's like some of these cases that you have, that we have, that's like, oh, it's like intimidating to try to tell it in a way that you're trying to give the most information, or it's a lot. But yeah, it's definitely good to highlight these cases. It's, I know we have some similar ones like that, not like just like that, but specifically with like Indigenous women, which is I think why it doesn't get, you know, so much attention. But the same in the States, because they're such big, like, big countries, there's like all of this road and for miles and miles and miles, and it's so remote in some places that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even fathom 450 miles of road. And yeah, that only forested. Being like, that only being like a small part of Canada. That's,
you're
like,
you're in Scotland.
I could get into like three different fucking countries if I know. 450 miles south. Exactly. Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you think like, It's enough of an area that there were three separate serial killers in this one location.
Yeah, that's
terrifying.
Bananas. Yeah.
Also, nothing good comes from hitchhiking.
No, please don't hitchhike, and please don't go to this area. I think it's cursed. Yeah. I think we should just rename the road or something. I don't know. Put something else there.
Yes.
But yeah, that is the Highway of Tears, a very brief overview. But please, like I said, if you want a deep dive, there is a lot of stuff on the internet. There are loads of cases. And there's three separate serial killers. So there's a lot there.
Happy New Year.
Yeah. I'm so sorry.
End on a high note.
Yeah. Great. Well, I think that's all we have for today. So if you want to check out our website, murderfriends.com, you can see Alana's sources that she used for today's episode. You can always email us any suggestions. We love receiving them, murderfriendspod@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter @murderfriendspd and on Instagram @murderfriendspod. And we'll see you next time.
Bye.